The World Bank in the 1990s, after decades of work trying to eliminate poverty, global poverty in the world, with some very mixed results, embarked on a new strategy. They did a survey of people in abject poverty. Some 60,000 people responded. And the core question of the survey was, what is poverty? The responses were pretty telling. I'm getting these from a book called When Helping Hurts, which summarizes part of that study. A person in Moldova said, "For a poor person, everything is terrible. Illness, humiliation, shame. We are cripples. We are afraid of everything. We depend on everyone. No one needs us. We are all like garbage that everyone wants to get rid of." A person in Latvia said, "During the last 2 years, we have not celebrated any holidays with others. We cannot afford to invite anyone to our house, and we feel uncomfortable visiting others without bringing a present. The lack of contact leaves one depressed, creates a constant feeling of unhappiness and a sense of low self-esteem." A person in Uganda said, "When one is poor, she has no say in public. She feels inferior. She has no food, so there is famine in her house. No clothing, no progress in her family." From Cameroon, "The poor have a feeling of powerlessness and an inability to make themselves heard." Ryan Fickert says, "Poor people typically talk about their experience in terms of shame, inferiority, powerlessness, humiliation, fear, hopelessness, depression, social isolation, and voicelessness. North American audiences tend to emphasize a lack of material things such as food, money, clean water, medicine, housing, etc. This mismatch between many outsiders' perceptions of poverty and the perceptions of poor people themselves can have devastating consequences for poverty alleviation efforts." Poverty is not so much about not having things. Poverty is about not having people. And I think about this passage in Deuteronomy where we're told again and again to care for the most vulnerable in our societies. And there's this repetition of the alien, the orphan, and the widow. The alien, the orphan, and the widow. And those are people that are particularly vulnerable because they don't have people. They don't have community. They don't have family. They don't have a support system to fall back on when there's a crisis. And so the people of Israel are instructed to be that support. I think about the man in the story Jesus tells who's on the side of the road. What he needs is not money. What he needs is people. Right? He needs someone to stop. This Thursday, I was talking with Sarah Litke, who, along with Sue Thompson, runs our Hearts of Hope ministry. And she had just gotten a communique from one of our local schools about a new family that had moved to town. They had arrived here from Texas, and they had no winter clothes. They didn't even have long pants for their kids. Two little children and parents. The little kids only spoke Spanish, but the parents were bilingual. And the school just said, "Hey, can you help us?" And we were so blessed to be able to say, "Yes, absolutely." And Sarah took that family pants and coats and the stuff you need for a winter in Wisconsin. And I thought, first of all, what a blessing to be in relationship. What a blessing to be in a situation where we get to be the people who stop, the people who are needed. And then I thought, boy, that's not going to be the end of that family's need. Now, I don't know this family any more than what I've just told you, but I can expect that if they're like many people, their need for help is going to continue. That one day, someone's going to have a medical bill, and they're going to have to make a choice between paying for the medical bill and paying for the rent. That one day, one of the parents is going to lose their job, and they'll go 2 weeks before they find another, and they'll have to make choices about what they do without help to keep paying their bills, keep food on the table. If mom and dad are both working, one of the challenges for that family is going to be that they're so busy working, they may not have time to care for their kids. They're trying to provide for them, but they may not have time to be the ones who sit at the kitchen table and work on the homework at night. They may not have the resources to pay for the school trip. They may not be able to take a child to an after-school activity. And I thought, boy, the need for that family just goes on. And that's the reality for everyone in that experience of poverty, that it's not just about needing resources, it's about needing people. And it's not just about needing people, it's about needing this ongoing relationship, this ongoing support, that we need people again and again and again. That's how we were designed. So we get this passage in the Gospel of Luke. This is a really interesting passage for a couple of reasons. The first is, we've heard this story in Matthew and in Mark, but Luke is different. Luke is different because in Matthew and Mark, this story happens at the end of Jesus' life. It's in the last week when he's in Jerusalem before his execution. But here, this is a different account. This is probably a common question, right? What is the great commandment? And so this is a different account. And in this story, it's not Jesus who defines the great commandments. Did you notice that? It's the man who asked the question, right? The lawyer is asked by Jesus, what do you think the law says? And it's the lawyer, not Jesus, in this passage who defines the great commandments. Love the Lord your God, love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus' answer and Jesus' interest is in something different. The question the lawyer asks is not what is the greatest commandment, but what must I do to inherit eternal life? The word in Greek is poieo, to do. And that word runs throughout this story. Jesus says, what do you think the law says? And the man responds, love God, love your neighbor. And Jesus says, do this, poieo, and you will live. And the man's concerned about how to do this, so he asks some more questions about who his neighbor is. And then at the end, you notice verse 37, Jesus says to the man, which of these was a neighbor? And the teacher of the law, the lawyer, says, the one who showed him mercy. But he doesn't say the one who showed him mercy. He says, the one who poieo'd him mercy, the one who did him mercy. And Jesus says, go poieo and do likewise. This is a passage that's not about what we believe. It's not about understanding the greatest commandment. It's about putting love into action. It's about what we do. And Jesus wants us to understand that we are called to participate in the rescuing work of God, to move from understanding to doing, to be people who stop. Now, the second question that the lawyer asks is an important one as well. He says, who then is my neighbor? And we're told in the scriptures that he asks this question because he wants to justify himself. But it's a relevant question, right? If we're told to love our neighbor as ourselves, who are the people that we are supposed to love that way? So the lawyer wants to know, is this my immediate family or my extended family? Is it my friends or my village? Is it my tribe? Is it all Israelites? And we ask those same questions, don't we? Who are we called to love as our neighbor? Is it family, friends, coworkers? Is it our physical neighbors whose names we can't always quite remember? Is it strangers? Is it aliens? Is it illegal aliens? What about those who are widows and orphans? What about those who are Democrats or Republicans? What about those women who've been harassed or assaulted and then are punished for speaking up? What about the men who've done the harassing and the assaulting? What about Muslims? What about felons? What about Vikings fans? And Jesus turns the question on its head. Jesus says, in a nutshell, this is the wrong question. This is a bad question. Eternal life is about participating in the rescuing work of God. Jesus tells a story about a certain man. A certain man was traveling from Jerusalem to Jericho. That's all we know about him. He's a certain man. Jesus doesn't tell us if he's a Jew or not. Doesn't tell us if he's a zealot or a Pharisee or a Sadducee, whether he's a faithful Jew or an unfaithful Jew, a sinner or a righteous man. All we know is he's a man. A certain man was traveling. We know he's on the road from Jerusalem to Jericho, which is a dangerous road, 17 miles. It's a hill country. Often violence happens, and as is often the case, this man is assaulted on this road. He's beaten. He's left for half dead on the side of the road. And then we start getting some details about people, because the first two people who come up, we know something about them. The first one is a priest. The second one is a Levite of the priestly tribe, both of whose jobs are about working in the temple. Now we're told that they see the man on the side of the road and they pass by on the other side. We're not told why. And people have conjectured, right? Maybe they're afraid they're going to get attacked. Maybe they're afraid it's a trick. Maybe they're afraid they're going to touch him and become ritually unclean. Whatever the reasons are, we're not told. Jesus leaves that out on purpose. He just tells us who they are, a priest and a Levite. Daryl Bach, a theologian who writes on this passage, says this is a critical detail. He says that the priest and the Levite participated in and were legitimated by the world of the temple, with its circumspect boundaries between clean and unclean, including clean and unclean people. They epitomize a worldview of tribal consciousness, concerned with relative status and us-them cataloging. They are living in this world where their association with the temple commends them as persons of exemplary piety whose actions would be regarded as self-evidently righteous. In other words, these men are good, not because of what they do, but because of their status, who they are. They work in the temple. And because they are good, we might very well, at this point, as a listener to Jesus, assume that what they are doing is right, because they are good. Their choice to walk by this man, at this point in the story, might be assumed to be the right choice. This has some basis in Jewish thought. So there's a book written between the Old and New Testament called the Book of Sirach. It's a book of Jewish wisdom. And in it, one of the passages says that you should do good, but know to whom you do it. Give to the one who is good, but do not help the sinner. So maybe these two men are not stopping because it's the right thing to do, because these are the right kind of people who are not stopping. And then we get the third figure, and we know something about him as well. We know he's a Samaritan. We know he's the wrong kind of person. Quasi-pagan, religious reject, half-breed. And we know he has the same experience. He walks down the road. He sees the man. But we're told something different about him. We're told that he's moved with pity. This is an unusual word. The word that Luke uses for pity here only shows up a few times in the Bible. It shows up in the first chapter of Luke, chapter 1, verse 78, in reference to the compassion of God for his people. It shows up in 7:13 in reference to Jesus' compassion for the woman whose son has died. And it shows up here. There's something of God about the compassion of this Samaritan. And that compassion trumps our concerns, whatever problems we might have, whatever might motivate us not to act. See, the opposite of love we all know is not hate, it's indifference. And indifference happens because we're just too busy, we're just too tired, we're just too stressed in the Advent season. Anybody feel busy, tired, and stressed? And so we end up being indifferent. We don't hate people, we just can't manage to care about that right now. This isn't a new problem. It's not an Advent problem. This goes on forever. We're in the midst of a revolution in our country related to an area of indifference we've ignored for a long time, kind of called the Me Too movement, right? This growing awareness of the incredible systems of sexual harassment and sexual assault that have been normalized in our culture for a very long time. Began with this guy, Harvey Weinstein, and it spread as women have spoken up about their experiences, and it's affected Hollywood publicists and producers and directors and actors. It's affected politicians. We've seen people in the House of Representatives, people in the Senate lose their jobs because people have spoken up and said, this is not how it's supposed to be. I saw a tweet this week from a woman who was talking about this experience, and I liked the way she said what she said. She said, I do feel bad for men with all the witch hunt stuff going on. Imagine being unsure if you could trust members of the opposite sex and worrying that anything you do could be misconstrued as sexual and second-guessing your own complicity. Oh, wait, that's called being a woman. That's what women deal with all the time. And I'm struck by the reality that this isn't a new problem. It's just that as a society, we've been indifferent for a long time. And now, thanks be to God, we're finding it difficult to be indifferent. The history of those with power is that people with power use it against people without. And we see this throughout human history in every way, shape, and form, except once, except the one time where the man who had literally all the power gave it up for the sake of the powerless. See, Jesus has always been political. Jesus has always been on the side of the oppressed against the oppressors. And he always calls us not to be indifferent, but to live into the difference of Christ, to live differently because of the compassion of our God, to participate in his rescuing work. That's what this Samaritan does. Now, this Samaritan embodies a Christ-like difference. He stops and he helps at risk to himself. He risks his life. He risks his money. He puts that man on his donkey and he walks for miles so that that man can be carried. And after solving the immediate crisis of treating his wounds and getting him to safety and taking him to the inn, he gives money to the innkeeper and he says, okay, take this now, but whatever else happens, whatever happens next, however much it costs, you put that on my tab and I'll come back and I'll settle the account. Whatever he needs, I will provide. Not help just once, not just in the crisis, but ongoing as long as it's needed. And in the midst of this story, I hope you can't help but notice the storyteller. That this is the story of Jesus. This is the story of a God who stopped and helped us up, who gave everything, even his very life for us, risked it for us, went to hell for us, ascended from the dead for us, and said, it's not just that I've come to help you with this one crisis, right? How often do we go to God and say, hey God, I just need you in this one moment. I'm having this crisis. This one bad thing is happening. If you help me with this, then I'll be all good. You can go help somebody else. And Jesus says, no, that's not how I work. If I come to help you, I'll help you forever. And Jesus says, whatever else goes on, this crisis and the next and the next and the sin you don't know that you have and the sin that you're embarrassed about and all the brokenness in your life, you just put all of that on my tab. And however long it runs, I'll keep paying it. And one day I'll come back and I promise I'll settle up. You don't have to pay anything. It's all on me. See, when we get that, when we begin to live into that experience, then our status and our identity changes. And this is the point that Jesus wants to make in this passage. It's not about the status of the person that we help. It's not about whether or not they are our neighbor. It's about whether we are their neighbor. That we are called, because we are those who have been redeemed by Christ, we are called to rescue and redeem others. That's part of what it means to be in relationship with our God. That status is irrelevant. Let the neighbor be you. Loving your neighbor means participating in the rescuing work of God. And this is, by the way, historically the greatest strength of the church. And in the early church, we've talked about the love apology, that which made the church compelling as a system of faith and a system of belief and a worldview for a Greco-Roman world that had never seen anything like it. And this ability of the church to love its neighbors well, to participate in the rescuing work of God is the most compelling argument for their faith. The early Roman world didn't have a system for supporting the poor. There wasn't any welfare. There wasn't any food stamps. And so the church became almost a miniature welfare state. There's a letter from the Bishop of Rome in 251 AD where, writing to another bishop, he says that his church individually supports 1,500 widows and distressed persons in their community. It's what the church did. There are moments in the history of the church where we did this incredibly well. In the early church, there were two great plagues in the Roman Empire, one around 160 AD and one around 250 AD. And those two plagues, we don't know for sure, we think Probably they were smallpox, the first advent of smallpox in Europe. But those two plagues were devastating. Between 1/4 and 1/3 of all the cities in the Roman Empire died, right? One-third of the people in the cities of the Roman Empire died. Marcus Aurelius, who was the Roman emperor in 165 AD, before he himself died of the plague, wrote about caravans of wagons and carts carrying out the dead every day from the city of Rome. And in that situation, the people whose loved ones were sick had very few options. They recognized that this was a communicable disease. And so very often, they simply took their loved ones when they became seriously ill and they laid them in the street next to the dying and the dead because they were so terrified of being infected themselves. It wasn't that they didn't love their family and their friends. They just didn't know what else to do. The world didn't offer other solutions. The Roman religions taught about gods that were capricious and couldn't care less about human suffering. The Roman philosophers taught that mercy was a weakness and that mercy was a function of injustice and was an impulse we should curb. The only people that were different were the Christians. Bishop Dionysius, during the second plague in 251, writes to his church about the experience of their faithful service to their sick and the sick around them. He says this, "Most of our brothers showed unbounded love and loyalty, never sparing themselves, thinking only of one another. Heedless of danger, they took charge of the sick, attending to their every need and ministering to them in Christ. And with them departed this life serenely happy. For they were infected by others with the disease, drawing on themselves the sickness of their neighbors and cheerfully accepting their pains. Many, in nursing and caring others, transferred their death to themselves and died in their stead. The best of our brothers lost their lives in this manner, the result of great piety and strong faith that seems in every way the equal to martyrdom." It turns out the Christian church made an incredible difference in these plagues, so much so, in fact, that the people around them began to notice that Christians and their friends and their neighbors survived the plagues at a dramatically superior rate. So much so that actually they began to tell stories about the miracles that were happening. It turns out that if you have someone with a disease like smallpox, simply providing food and water and basic physical care without any medicinal need increases your survival rate by about 66%. And so the Christians were living because they were caring for each other. And the Christians' neighbors who were not believers and their friends who were not believers were living because the Christians were caring for them. And the whole Roman Empire began to notice what is going on with these people that are risking their lives in order to care for their loved ones and the people around them that are not part of their community. And why is it that they're saved and we're not? And it became this incredible love apology for the church. I mentioned that the Bishop of Rome said in 251 that they were caring for 1,500 widows and distressed persons in their church. It's an interesting number for me because this week I got a note from our denomination. It was a questionnaire. We were asked to fill out all these numbers about our church. And one number they asked us to fill out was, how many people outside of your membership has your church touched this year? It was actually a hard thing to figure out, so I started counting, and I figured, okay, we have 250, 300 families through individuals through Hearts of Hope that we serve. We'll take 300 Christmas dinners to families in our community. Don't know how many food pantry clients, 60 to 80 families every pantry. Let's call that hundreds. We sent 10,000 meals to Madagascar to serve kids in schools there who are hungry. We work with 30 people twice a month at the warming center. We visited every gas station and hotel attendant in our area about the anti-trafficking ministry we're working on here. And we sent a mailing to everyone in a 3-mile radius inviting them to come to worship. We've had over 150 first-time guests come to our church this week. This year. We've had community gardens work. We've had the scouts and the crew and the football team and the basketball team. And I said the answer is thousands, right? Thousands of people that our church has touched. Thousands of people that our church has loved and stopped for and cared about and ministered to and tried to be part of the rescuing work of God. Jesus' people rescue people because we've been rescued by Jesus. Jesus' people rescue people because we've been rescued by Jesus. So maybe the most important question for us this Advent season is, Who is your neighbor? And to whom are you a neighbor? Because Jesus tells us to love our neighbors as ourselves. Thanks be to God.